the noise ratio fed back to you on the RSSI. While the conversation is in process, you may discover that the east-west antenna gives the best reception when the guy in Florida is talking, and the north-south antenna gives the best reception when the guy in Ohio is talking. And you're just doing this quick little experiment while they're talking, not interrupting their conversation. You're just looking at the meters. And you have the ability, by flipping the switches, to maximize the signal-to-noise ratio for that particular conversation, for that particular hour of that day. So even without being an annoyance, you can do this experiment, in my opinion. Back to you, Howie.
Absolutely. So by the way, you don't think there's much of an advantage if you take two inverted V's, have them, you know, oddly, you know, one going in one direction, one going in, you know, east, west, north, south, and then running them 90 degrees out of phase. You don't think I'll see any real difference. Is that what you're telling me?
I started off saying that, and I backed away from it. Here's why. And that's why I chose all three positions. First, have the ability to feed only the east-west inverted V. That's position number one of the relays. Position number two, you feed only the north-south. And position three, you feed both of them clockwise. And position four, you feed both of them counterclockwise. Guarantee some days of some hours, you're going to see advantage of mode one over two, or two over three, or whatever. There is a difference. Is it a major difference or a minor difference? I'm not sure anymore. You are going to be playing with polarimetry. It's a whole area that has only barely been touched on by ham radio operators on 10 meters. Polarimetry. Polarimetry agility. Polarization agility. Pattern agility. You're playing with it all at once. In the receiving mode, those relays can be tiny little relays, nothing expensive. Impedance matching is not super important. Even if when you're feeding two of them versus one of them, you get a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, that's nothing to the receiver. Don't even have to bother going through all the elaboration of impedance matching. I think you see where I'm going with this one, Howie. I think it's a great Edisonian experiment. Go try it. Back to you, Howie.
Yeah, man, if you go to, by the way, if you Google KQ2H, he's doing some really interesting stuff with horizontal beams and rotators. All right, Dick. Yeah, well, actually, a 2-to-1 SWR, you're not even going to see dB. You're not transmitting. So even if I didn't come up with a quarter wave transformer, and I'm just going into, you know, into the front end of this receiver, I don't think you would see more than a half a dB to 3/4 of a dB of difference. And at those frequencies, they really don't mean anything. Dick, can I ask you to do one more thing? I want you to look at somebody's antenna. And actually, I think this guy's making claims that's a little ridiculous. Can you Google 10-meter delta loop? Just Google it. Guy has made a 10-meter delta loop with two full-wave delta loop beams, basically. He's basically feeding, he has two antennas, basically, on a boom. A 10-foot-away part, and he's basically feeding a reflector and a driven element, and he's claiming he gets 10 dBs of gain.
My goodness, that sounds high. Just a driven element and a reflector, if I understand you correctly. 10 dB of gain? I don't think so. A three-element, well-tuned Yagi, and I've used zillions of them in the last 3 years. With very good laboratory instrumentation. Just a skosh over 6 dB over isotropic is the best gain you're going to get out of 3-element Yagi, very well tuned. 6 dB over isotropic. Back to you, Howie.
That's it, Roger. I'm going to pull it back to you. My battery is dying. Just take a look at it. 10-meter delta loop. I think the guy is way off base.
It doesn't sound good. Mel, we finally gave it back to you again. K2KUY, go right ahead.
Okay, this is K2KUY. All right, well, I'm trying to wait, but it's up to you. Want to look at another one? I can pick out some interesting ones over.
Yeah, I bet you've got a couple of them. Go for it.
Okay, here's one from Joe. He says, you guys mentioned something in the past. What did we mention in the past? Let me read this over. About matching. Oh, and I did the Smith chart. Okay, I gave her an example. That's fine. And you brought up, I think you said it was the conjugate. The conjugate match theorem. I think he's referring to the conjugate match theorem of that was Walt Maxwell's one of his articles, another look at reflection. I believe that it was back in one of the reflection articles that Walt Maxwell did years ago. So now what does he want is the question. Did you mention, in the Smith chart, I'll just quickly touch upon it. You can go back and look at it yourself, but all right. I see he doesn't quite understand some things about it, how he gets into it. He said you had, for instance, a cable that has an impedance of 90 minus J160. I remember. So, all right, what did I mean by that all again? Well, quickly again, it means 90 ohms resistor, 160 ohms capacitor. So if we apply an impedance of 90 ohms plus J160, the 160 will minus 160, and the plus J160 will cancel, and that will leave us with a match of 90 ohms. That's basically what I said. Okay, next part of it. If you do this, if this is correct, the theorem means that when we tune our tuner, match our transmitter, so the SWR is 1, then the tuner output will match the impedance of the antenna cable. Will it mean also that the antenna end of the cable matches the antenna? That's the question. Okay, that's what we got to this. Over.
Yeah. As I take any antenna that is a standing wave structure, dipole, Yagi, whatever, any of these antennas that you really tune, where in general when you sweep them, you get a standing wave ratio plot, which looks a little bit like a bathtub, or in the extreme case, it looks like a U or a V. When you go to the left of resonance, you get one kind of reactance. When you go to the right of resonance, you know, higher frequency, you get another kind. When we talk about 50 plus J120, what we're really saying is that the network analyzer, any of your other instrumentation, makes a reading, and it tells you those numbers for the resistive component and the reactive component. You could make an exact equivalent of that dipole at that frequency, consisting of a 50-ohm resistor in series with a capacitor, with a capacitive reactance. You change the magnitude in picofarads of the capacitor so that at that frequency it presents 120 ohms of capacitive reactance. And you put that capacitor in series with that resistor, and you put that on your network analyzer instead of your real antenna, and you would not be able to tell the difference between the two. So that resistor and that capacitor is an equivalent circuit for the way your antenna is acting at that frequency at this time. That's an equivalent circuit. Once you accept that as an equivalent circuit, then you can go one step further with the equivalent circuit. It was a 50-ohm resistor in series with a capacitor of 110 ohms. If I put one more object in series with those two, the third object would be an inductor with a series reactance of 120 ohms. The 120 ohms of inductor reactance, we call that positive reactance. That's just a convention. The inductor the capacitor reactance of 110 ohms, we call that negative. And in series, you're allowed to add the negative and the positive, and they cancel and become zero. And you're ending up with 50 ohms. So that's one way of looking at what impedance matching is doing. But the main question he's asking is that if you look into a transmission line, and at the far end of that transmission line is some kind of an exotic antenna, doesn't matter, and if at the input end of the transmission line you see, let's just take an example, 50 ohms minus J110, and you do whatever is required so that at that junction, right at the input end of that transmission line. You now have matched 50 ohm minus J110. So that now, that matching network, we'll call it an antenna tuner. Your transmitter sees 50 ohms, perfect. The antenna tuner does its thing because the antenna tuner has matched itself to the input end of the transmission line. The first step of your virtual question is, does all the power out of the transmitter go into the antenna tuner and into the input end of the transmission line? Yes, yes. And once you've done that, does that give you an impedance match at the far end of the transmission line? And the answer is absolutely yes. Assuming the transmission line is low in loss, matching at one end is matching at both ends at the same time. A little hard to believe. Take my word for it. It is happening. If you dig one step further, the fact that you measured some reactance at the end of the, at your input end of the transmission line, told you there really is some standing wave ratio at the antenna to feed line junction. Something is not perfect out there. By definition, there is standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio is another way of saying that of all the power I pour down that transmission line, on the first pass, the antenna doesn't accept it all. It reflects some of it back toward the transmitter. And you do your impedance matching with your antenna tuner at the transmitter end of the feed line. Now the whole system is matched. The slight disadvantage is now the power is bouncing back and forth a number of times in the transmission line before the antenna accepts it all. As long as the transmission line is low enough in loss, you apply 100 watts into the input of this system, and it will radiate 99 watts of that into space. There's a couple of charts in the antenna handbook of ARRL that once you go to the chart and you know what is the standing wave ratio on your transmission line, that's raw input piece of information number one, and raw input information piece of number two is you know what is the matched insertion loss of that transmission line. If, for instance, it was 100 ohms, 100 feet of RG8U at 432 megacycles, I know it's at 4.5 dB of loss. That's the RG8 rating, 4.5 dB of loss per 100 feet at 432 megacycles. So that's my second piece of information, the matched loss of the transmission line. You go to that curve, that graph, it'll tell you what is the additional loss because the signal doesn't go through at once, it's bouncing back and forth with a decreasing level on each bounce, sort of like a ringing bell damping out, so to speak, on each wave you're sending down there. So you get a little bit of extra loss. But other than that, it is the perfect match. So matching one end is matching both ends once you include this bouncing signal phenomenon. Now, once you get a little bit smarter, and if you want that last few percent of improvement in radiation efficiency, you could do some kind of impedance matching at the antenna end to remove the visoir on the cable, and now the antenna tuner doesn't have to do anything, and the whole system becomes a little bit more efficient. If your feed line is low enough in loss to begin with, and if you're at a low enough frequency where it's got low loss, that's nothing to worry about. The only disadvantage left now, even though you're getting 90-some-odd percent efficiency, is that the system becomes tuned. That really means when you QSY, you're going to have to readjust the controls on the antenna tuner. But you could write yourself a chart, memorize them, put them into a lookup table, or in some antenna tuners, it automatically goes to the lookup table and adjusts itself when you QSY. Whereas if you had a perfect impedance match at the antenna, you could go to a new frequency and you don't have to readjust the controls. So other than that minor annoyance, there's not much of a disadvantage of having low-loss cable running at relatively high standing wave ratio. K2KE1, K2RIW.
Roger, exactly. This is K2KE1. Okay, see, this is where it is. I want to know what is the accuracy of all the... Well, all right. I remember when we did this on the SMIT chart, yes, what I had done with the experiment. This was actually before I actually did the, you know, did the tweet, which I had lately on the SMIT chart. This was part of an experiment to find out how accurate the adjustments on the tuner were. And what I had done at the time, I had mentioned, I did this little experiment I took it to my general radio, 916 RF bridge, and I made some as best as I could, the most accurate measurements. So I hooked up, I managed to get this, that's how I picked this 90 minus J160. I managed to get this resistor and capacitor set up. Just happened to fall to minus 90 minus J160 at about, it was around, if I remember, around 4 megahertz. So I was, what I did is, I took a tuner, and I connected the tuner, and I adjusted it so that the tuner side, the transmitter side would reach 50 ohm. Next, I substituted the, a 50 ohm non-inductive resistor to the transmitter side, and I made the same, got the match set up and everything like that. And then I went back to read 90, figured reading 90 plus J160. So when I reconnected the RF bridge to the output side, I read 100 plus J140. So you see that there is not a perfect, that was I was trying to prove, that's where I guess the confusion came in. What I was trying to show that there isn't a perfect transformation, but it's close enough to that minus 90 plus 160. So showing that the tuner, no, you're not going to get a perfect, but it's close enough. I think that's what he wants to know, how accurate it is. That shows you what I did, the experiment that I came out with from 90 minus one J160, which I figured I would get 90 plus one J160. I came out with 100 plus J140. That was basically what I was alluding to Dick at the time. Over.
Yeah, those percentages, some of those drop. Yeah, so we got a beeper now, we got to worry. Those percentages of errors you've got now are in the real world very small. And what you're describing is a instrumentation procedure that appears to present some error. In reality, if your standing wave ratio measuring equipment back at the transmitter is accurate, and you adjust your antenna tuner so that that instrumentation sees one-to-one standing wave ratio, believe me, you created a perfect match in that system with that hardware. It's not the most ideal, because on that transmission line in general, there is some signal bouncing back and forth before the antenna finally absorbs it all. But as long as you know the magnitude of that visor, calculatable and measurable, as long as you know the matched insertion loss of your particular length, of your particular piece of cable, at that frequency, if you go to the chart, it'll tell you what the extra loss is because of the visor. And in most cases, it's not much of a perturbation. We're talking about a very small fraction of an S unit of signal strength difference if the guy in the other end has a well-calibrated S meter. So this is not to lose a lot of sleep over. These are the typical things that people worry about when they're first learning how transmission line and impedance matching work. Once you've been there long enough, you realize if I create a good match at one end, except for the bouncing signal, I've created a perfect match everywhere else in the system. You have to go through the experiment a few times like you did, and don't get extremely excited about the fact that you throw a couple of percent of error from what you expected to see. That's essentially the answer. In that particular case, the error is a red herring. You have to be a little bit careful. There are some science experiments people have done in the past, like the experiment Mr. Cavendish did when he was trying to measure the gravity constant. And he saw a little bit of error in the experimentation, in the way he was measuring gravity constant between two heavy balls in his laboratory. Mr. Cavendish was himself a big, heavy man. There was another chunk of mass in the middle of the experiment, him, which he ignored, and therefore he developed a little bit of error in his measurement. So there are times when the apparent error is not something you ignore. It's telling you something you should recognize and know about. But in this particular experiment, I think the error is a red herring, and it's small. Don't lose sleep over it. If you've got 95% efficiency in your antenna system, and you lose a whole lot of sleep and you get it up to 97%, nobody but you will know the difference. Back to you, Mel. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, Roger, this is KQKUY. No, I was just trying to, you know, like you said, nitpick it. I just wanted to show that at that time, too, that, you know, tools do have water. They're not perfect. However, the conjugate match theorem of Walt Maxwell does work. Okay, so we put it simply that way. It does make sense that that Walt Maxwell has been smart. All right, that's that one, Dick. Have you had enough?
Let's try one more. Choose a good one.
Oh, okay, here we are. Let's see. What is this one? Joe. Joe. Oh, here we go. You mentioned the isotron. You guys talk about Lupin Venison, your experiments with this indoor Lupin, blah, blah, and so on and so forth. And that's a very tiny antenna. Yes. Now, isotron sells one, which I bought at a ham fest, very cheap, because, well, everybody from there knows that. It said, you won't deal too much with it. What does he want? Oh, the 40-meter version. And he says, isotron claimed they had a bandwidth of 100 kilohertz. Does this mean that a bandwidth let me try to understand. If a wide bandwidth on an antenna this small would suggest a very lossy system, is that correct? Are you familiar with the isotron, over?
Yes, I am, and he's wearing unnecessarily. Q of the antenna, bandwidth of the antenna, and efficiency of the antenna, you could almost say, are all independent variables. By the same token, there's many a person who thinks that just because he's adjusted the antenna for a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, that automatically the antenna is 100% efficient. Well, I could have a feed line that goes out of the shack, is going toward the antenna. I don't know it, but somebody has put another connector in the middle of my cable and plugged in a 10 decibel attenuator in the middle of the cable, and then the rest of the cable goes up to the antenna, and I sit in the shack and I do whatever adjusting is required to get a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio through my antenna tuner in the shack, and I can easily sit there and assume that, okay, no energy is being reflected back to the transmitter, it's all going out the feed line, therefore it's all being radiated by the antenna. You can see by that silly little example of mine that the 9/10 of the power is going to be attenuated by and turned into heat by that 10 dB attenuator, and only 10% of the power goes on to the antenna. So standing wave ratio and antenna efficiency in the big picture are reasonably unrelated. Lots of guys get that one confused. Now, the bandwidth of the antenna of 100 kc usually in the amateur literature means when I go above and below, 50 kc above and 50 kc below, those are the points where a well-matched antenna at center frequency hits 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Usually when you talk about the bandwidth of an antenna, they're talking about the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio bandwidth. And it's possible the guy could be using a different definition, because many a transmitter these days starts giving you some grief, solid-state transmitter, that doesn't want to see more than a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. He could be telling you the bandwidth of 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. But in either case, that's where the standing wave ratio hits 2-to-1. At 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, if the transmitter was a perfect 50 ohm source, that would represent a half dB of loss. At the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, half dB of the power that could have been radiated has gotten lost, which is a very small loss. 2-to-1 is nothing to lose sleep about, except for the way the transmitter behaves. A real transmitter is not a 50-ohm source. It's a constant current generator. So the power that's reflected from the antenna cannot be absorbed by the transmitter. It gets re-reflected forward again, and in most cases, it eventually gets radiated. So even the calculated half dB of loss at the 2 to 1 standing wave ratio frequency in the real world is not true, as long as your feed line is low and long. So standing wave ratio, as W2DU, I can't think of Mr. Maxwell's first name. Anyhow, again, one more time.
W-A-L-T.
Yes, Walt Maxwell, W2DU. Some of his early articles were entitled Reflections on Reflection. He is reflecting on the misconceptions of people discussing reflected energy, standing wave ratio, highly misunderstood area. And the physics as to why a transmission line behaves as it does is some darn interesting stuff. You go into a real good RF engineering company and you ask them the simple question about any reasonable quality coaxial cable or any other kind of transmission line. Does that cable keep the signal that's flowing forward thoroughly separate from the signal that's flowing in reverse? The answer is yes. The majority of engineers will say no, because the standing wave ratio, the forward going signal, and the reverse going signal are interacting. And from their point of view, when they used a slotted line in the old days, they thought they were visualizing and seeing the interaction. There is none. That transmission medium keeps the forward and reverse signal thoroughly separate. Doesn't matter if it came from the same transmitter and the same antenna reflecting. Those are two independent events that keep proceeding. And that alone gives a lot of people grief. What in the world is going on? How does this magic transmission line keep that separate? As smart as that guy is, XQ2FOD, Manfred von Hinwig, the smartest engineer they got down there at the Las Salinas facility in Chile of that telescope, the optical telescope setup. That's the one subject he and I have passed thousands of words back and forth, multiple emails, and we have agreed to disagree on that particular subject. He's got a mental image of how transmission line, in his head, it works for him. I've got another one. It works for me. The real bottom line of what's happening at the molecular level, we're going to argue about that until our dying day. I see it coming. He ain't going to settle that one. That's okay. It's interesting. But back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KY. Here's the follow-up on this. This guy, Jack, he's the one that owns the isotron. He's the one originally bought the isotron, and he says, I feel a little guilty that I pawned it off on a good friend, but I gave it to him for the same price as I paid for it. this is funny. He says, and all my tests with this thing, I found I was always 2S units lower. I guess 12 dB, 2S units, 12 dB lower. And he says, and this is, I can understand, because let's face it, a dipole 40 meters, 66 feet long, and an isotron, which is only 22 inches high, I figured it only has a bandwidth, I would say, about 11 kilohertz. So how can they claim a bandwidth of 100 kilohertz? It must be explained only as loss. So I figure this is a So more antennas, if they were efficient, they have to be extremely narrow. So you won't get out with this thing. You're better off putting up a full-size dipole in your backyard for 40 meters. Forget about if you face, unless you face some place that they don't permit you to put an antenna, then you should go to this isotron. Otherwise, it's not worth the money unless you buy it like I did. It's very cheap.
Okay, let me let it drop. Jack made a statement, he made a measurement, and he came to a conclusion. I strongly disagree with Jack in this area. He saw 12 dB, 2S units of difference. And by the way, the way most S meters and receivers are calibrated, 2S units might only be 6 dB of difference, not 12. They tend to be very liberal. But I won't even get in that area. He saw a difference. I believe the difference was real in what he measured. But there's a catch. He saw the isotron give weaker reception by either 12 dB, he thought, or 6 dB, I think. Doesn't matter. But weaker reception. That's true. He assumed the weaker reception is due to a lower efficiency of the antenna. Here's where I disagree. He made a huge difference between the two comparisons, and he forgot about the difference. That dipole up in the air is at a different altitude than that isotron that's in the shack with him. That altitude difference makes a huge difference in what signal strength he got and what the vertical takeoff angle was. When you take a full-size dipole up in the air and squeeze it down to an isotron-sized antenna up in the air at the exact same location, you will lose less than one-half of 1 dB. And I'm not kidding. 2.14 dB goes down to 1.76 dB. Krauss, the founding father of antennas, at least the antenna book, said it. Had a lot of mathematics to back it up. Laboratory measurements to back it up. The infinitesimal size dipole that is built with the right material so it doesn't have I squared R loss, resistive heating loss. When you go from full-size dipole to infinitesimally small dipole, well impedance match, you only lose half a dB. That's real. But because his isotron was so much lower, he saw a much, much weaker signal. He didn't compare the altitude, not a fair test. Of course that doesn't make sense. I know it seems obvious that of any reasonable horse sense and common sense. I don't blame you for being skeptical at first. You've seen it with your loop experiment. Krauss saw it with his laboratory experiment. I'm convinced it's real. That isotron will give you the performance you want if you put it at the right altitude. And if you don't have the altitude to put it at, it gets you on the air where you ordinarily wouldn't be on the air. Not a bad antenna. And each time you 2SY to a new frequency, you may have to retune it. Big deal. That's not bad. I wouldn't recommend putting a full gallon into that antenna and operating it 5 feet away from your body. That's pushing your luck a little bit with radio frequency biohazard. But other than that, I think it's an extremely good antenna. Everyone believes small antennas have low efficiency. If you think it has low efficiency, if you think it has low efficiency, then do the experiment. Do the conservation of energy experiment. Of all that valuable power you send down that transmission line into your antenna, there's only three things the antenna can do with it. Reflect some of it back to the transmitter. You measure that with your bird watt meter in the reverse mode, as Biswa. He can reflect some of the power back, and you can find out how much. He can absorb some of the power and turn it into heat. I'll come back to that in a minute. Or he can radiate it into space and it's gone forever. That he absorbs, you can measure it. Run the transmitter key down, 100 watts output, for one solid minute. Lift up the key, run over there and touch the antenna. If the antenna is cold, he is not dissipating energy. If your Biswa meter says he's not reflecting the energy, then he's not reflecting it. There's only one thing left. He's got to be radiating it. So on any antenna you build, or any piece of electronics you build, that is an antenna is passive. You don't give it a power supply. Any passive piece of electronics, if you have a doubt, give it a calorimetry test. Pour power into it, find out if it gets hot. If it's cold, it ain't wasting energy. There's nothing left. There's no mechanism that's explainable left where the inefficiency is coming from. K2KUI, K2LAW.
All right. Okay. Very good. Yeah, they go on and on here, Dick. I should say, some of them are very interesting. I read through quite a number of them while you were talking. And I'm trying to pick out ones, you know, that with young people and stuff, misconception. This is terrible. I'm telling you. All right. It's up to you. One more.
We're on a roll. Go for it.
Okay. There's another young person. My friend says that if I better use bare insulated wire for my antenna, because the installation, what it's going to do, it's going to change the resonant frequency of my dipole, so I have to compensate for it. This will be good, but as the installation will begin to fall apart, thin out, and start flaking off, my antenna is going to have to be constantly recut. Is that correct, over?
Oh, wise tale.
Yeah, a lot of people believe it. To a degree, it's true, but it's a spitting in the ocean argument. Even if Howie and I both spit into the ocean at the same time, and you try to measure the new altitude of the ocean, I can tell you it's going to be very difficult. But yes, all the laws of physics say that when Howie and I spit into that ocean, the ocean is at a new altitude, a new depth. That's the truth. You just can't measure it. Okay. Every flat-out dipole made out of household wire with insulation, for instance, whether you leave the insulation on or off, is there a difference? Extremely minor. On an 80-meter dipole, 135 feet long, you did a careful experiment. I think the difference would be about 1 inch of length to reestablish resonance. And how do you establish resonance of a dipole? The simplest way is to plot the standing wave ratio across the band. And the bottom of the U-shaped curve usually is defined as the point of resonance. And so if the resonance occurs too far to the left, you know the antenna is a little bit too long. And if it's too far to the right, the antenna is a little bit too short. In the case of a dipole, if you want to add some extra length, you put a clip lead on the end of it. And if that's too much, you either use a shorter clip lead or move the clip lead closer to the center. Lots of ways you can go here. And these are minor perturbations, very minor. And if you've got an antenna tuner, you can tune it out. Even as the insulation deteriorates, you just readjust your antenna tuner 1 degree further to the right on the right-hand knob, if you know what I mean, if it's a manual antenna tuner. If it's an automatic one, you'll never even know the difference. On top of that, we all lose sleep about 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. The point of 2-to-1 is only half a dB of loss on the worst-case transmitter, a 50-ohm source transmitter. On real transmitters, even the half a dB of loss doesn't exist. So these are things not to worry about. If you like to protect the copper of your dipole so that it doesn't tarnish as fast, leave the insulation on. The RF doesn't see it. The RF had to go through some trees and houses to get to your house. If it's got to go through another 16th of an inch of rubber insulation on the wire, that is minor. It ignores that, goes down to the copper, and says, aha, there's a conductor, and now the signal does its thing on that copper wire. It doesn't see the insulation. So whether or not you leave on the insulation is a mechanical decision. Whether you want the extra wind loading, whether you want the extra protection of the wire, and if the insulation is made out of nice slippery material, maybe the ice that wants to form on the antenna in the wintertime will flake off more easily. So there's pros and cons. I've done it both ways. I was happy with both antennas. I never saw any difference. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I believe the RRL manual says 3%. It should allow 3% for insulated type of household wire, like number 12 wire. You buy it off the reel, and it'll allow 3% when you do your calculation. All right. Oh, boy, what is this? Oh, my God. I got to read this over. I got so many of them here, Dick. I don't know if I'm coming to go in, to tell you the truth. But quickly, how many radios do you really need? One person says to me, 16 will do it. Somebody else says, I'm a professional ham, and writes an article and says, oh, no, you need a minimum of 24. Actually, how many do you really think I should really put down to get on the air properly? That's a good question. I guess as many as you can possibly manage, over.
By the way, that 3% number that's in the ARO handbook, I think it's not real. They're requesting that you leave 3% extra wire so that if it's too long, you can now rewrap that end insulator so that it becomes a little bit shorter. You can always subtract wire. to add wire is a little bit more difficult for mechanical reasons. If you just twist on some extra wire to increase the length, it's possible that last twist is going to come apart on you. So the 3% they ask you to make extra before you do the tuning is not necessarily because of the rubber, in my opinion. But just make sure you've got excess. Now, I've already forgotten the question you just gave me. Boy, thank goodness I'm not getting senile. Give me one or two words again on the subject.
Yeah, no, I looked it up. The insulation lowers here, right out of the ARRL book. The insulation lowers the resonant frequency of your dipole by 3%. So you need to use a shorter length. This is according to the laboratory, ARRL Labs, Dick Over.
Okay, I could be wrong on that one. Easily. There was a second question, though. I went back to the 3%, which is the previous question, and you asked a new question on the one you're reading right now, and I've already lost the subject.
That's an old radio question. Let's see. I read in a magazine that all the so-called professional amateur radio operators who use verticals have at least 24 radios, and how much can I expect losses, and how different will my signal be, and is the number worth adding, will increase my signal strength, increase my field strength, if I go from 16 radios to 24? All right, that's a quickie, over.
If I've got the right resources, real estate, towers, trees, and whatever, the whole problem is moot. I should be mute. If you raise the antenna to a new altitude and make it a vertically polarized full half-wave dipole, or the electronically shrunk down version of it, zigzag, top hat, floating coils, whatever, a pure vertical antenna at some altitude, even fed at one end, not fed at the center, will have a hell of a lot more performance than a good ground plane antenna on the ground with 1,000 radials. So, yeah, we can talk about how many angels we can put on the head of a pin. We can talk about what performance you're going to get when you go from 16 radials to 20, to 24, to 36, to 100, and so on. I'm not sure you want to go there. It's a law of diminishing returns. If you plotted performance of the antenna versus the number of radials, that slope is going to come up real fast as you go from 2 to 3 to 4 radials. The slope is going to start flattening out as you get out to 16 radials. And there's a little bit more beef left as you get up to 24 and 30 radials. And is that the end of the story? Well, if you want the last 3% more efficiency, you can go from 36 radials to 50 radials. You can have a grand old time and fill up your backyard with copper. Or you can build one simple vertical dipole, maybe electronically shortened, and mount it at whatever altitude you've got above ground, and you're going to get a lot more performance out of it. Or a horizontal dipole. The reason I use vertical dipole as a comparison is that maybe you like vertical polarization for some reason. There's no good reason, but maybe you like vertical polarization, and you want to keep it vertical. I'm not an enthusiast anymore of quarter-wave ground plane antennas with counterpoise radials on the ground. Put the antenna up at, let me pick a number, 30 foot of altitude, and you're going to get the full performance out of 4 radials. Make it a pure vertical half-wave dipole, and you're going to get full performance out of 1 radial. That's the other half of the dipole. You get a lot more bang for the dollar with altitude. And antennas on the ground with a zillion radials, they do perform. But you and I are seeing lots of emails that we're getting, Mel, where the guy who puts down a zillion radials on the ground, he's put forth a heroic effort. He's got brand A Cadillac antenna. And as an experiment, he throws up a simple dipole in the trees, and it works better. And he says, what in the world's going on? I think we know. Altitude is much more important than the number of radials. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Another part that is his friend, Aaron. He says, Well, we get on the air, and I showed him how come I always have a better signal. And the reason for this is because he put up a half wave. No, what the heck did he do? Yes, the half wave vertical. He put up a half wave vertical. And it does work without radios, but my quarter wave vertical with radios always seems to put out a better signal, showing that my idea of using a quarter wave vertical with a bunch of radios is a much better way to go than him without his radios and his half wave vertical. That's what Aaron says. He's answering his question. They both wanted to put their 2 cents in on this pick over.
Yeah, there's more variables here that meet the eye. Will I be happier if I marry a redhead or a brunette or blonde? One guy with a ground plane antenna in his backyard is comparing another guy in some other town, in some other location, behind some other building at some other altitude, a halfway dipole in the air. Not a very fair comparison. And even if he did make the comparison, how many days in a row did he make it with how many different states of the ionosphere? I mean, the possibility exists that the guy they were talking to in common, the third person, when that signal got through their town, assuming the two hams are in the same town, maybe that signal was primarily vertically polarized. And therefore the ground plane vertically polarized antenna had more performance than the horizontally polarized dipole. So it may not be a fair comparison. Most likely it's not. Got to be the same altitude, same polarization before you compare the antenna. Now, a ground plane vertical antenna with lots of radials is an extremely good antenna for an AM broadcast station. Winds 1010 New York. 1.01 megacycle. With probably, I'm going to pick a number here, an 800-foot high tower with a zillion ground plane radios. Beautiful antenna. They do not have the ability, within the laws of physics and reasonable dollar expenditure, to put up a vertically polarized half-wave dipole. It'd be something like 3,000 feet high. And they don't have the resources to do that. So at that lower frequency, that's the best antenna they can put up. They could put up a horizontally polarized antenna at a reasonable altitude, but it would have nulls off the edge, off the end, and they wouldn't have complete coverage across around the compass. Although what we're finding out right now, I think they should consider putting up a horizontally polarized inverted V antenna. The possibility exists, but that's going to give them a lot more bang for the dollar. But there, I'm not sure. The tradition has been an AM broadcast tower. 400, 500, 600, 700 feet tall, a substantial steel structure with a bunch of guy wires and a bunch of cake insulators on the guy wires and a bunch of ground plane radios. That's the tradition. You apply for an FCC license for your AM broadcast station with some radical new design, and you're going to get a lot of flack. You may not get your license proposal approved. So there, the frequencies are so low, the wavelengths are so big, they've got so few choices. That's a good antenna, damn good antenna. Lots of history behind it. But you go all the way up to 3.5 megacycles, 7 megacycles, and 14 megacycles, it becomes more and more difficult to justify that antenna. Yes, you can buy an 80 to 10 meter multi-band trap dipole vertical quarter wave type of antenna. The good news is it covers a lot of frequencies. The bad news, to really get high performance requires a lot of radials, and it's down low. I don't think you're getting very much bang for the dollar. And so these comparisons, where one's horizontal, one's vertical, two different homes, two different towns, two different altitudes of the land, two different altitudes of the antennas, it may not be a fair comparison. Back to you, Mel. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I want to disagree about one thing, Dick. You said earlier that running a high-standing wave on World War coax is okay. I And also, Saturday at 2 MB had the same experience. His kids, we wondered why, and we didn't know each other then. We were doing this separately without knowing why a random wire dipole gave miserable performance on 80 meters. And then I went to open wire line and got tremendous improvement. Barry went to open wire line and got the same improvement. So what we concluded is that if you're running a resonant dipole, coax is okay. If you're going to run a non-resonant antenna with a tuner, open wire line is the way to go.
And I agree with you guys. At some of those bands, your random length of wire could have been so non-resonant that it gave you a reactive impedance of, let me pick a number, 5,000 ohms, 10,000 ohms, in which case you maybe had, if it was 10,000 ohms, you maybe had a 500 to 1 standing wave ratio. Even though you're using low loss coax, when you get a standing wave ratio that high, everything becomes lossy. And now the difference between the ladder line, which is a higher impedance, which comes closer to matching it in the first place, and it's got tremendously lower loss, the combination is a significant improvement. I'm going to agree with you guys. Not many of us nowadays, though, are running an untuned antenna, a random length of wire, where we want to use it on multiple bands with an antenna tuner. So, I'm no longer as troubled by what you guys saw as I see more of the facts involved. Back to you, Mel. Your choice, K2LIW.
Can I make one more comment, Rich?
Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
What I said this year when Barry and I put the dipole up higher, I went to a fold dipole, which has a characteristic impedance of about 300 ohms. I made it out of open wire line, and here's a fold dipole with open wire line. And that's fantastic results. This past winter, I was getting into Europe on 75 meters like nobody did.
Have you ever fed that folded dipole with coax?
I know what you're saying, make an experiment. No, I haven't. It just worked so well, I figured it'd leave well enough alone.
I agree. But if you fed it with coax, with a half-wave coax balance, you may find identical performance. So the difference isn't coax versus open wire line for a resonant antenna. But for a non-resonant antenna, where that end impedance could be a huge number, I'm going to be with you. Open wire line is the right way to go on that one. K2KE1, K2LAW, your choice, Bill.
Okay, this is K2KY. Yeah, well, I guess I've gone through that situation with the open wire feeders, and as far as the outside loop, it seems to be the best of all worlds, but initially I did have some problems, you can remember, with that, but I couldn't, with the balancing of the current in both lines, why I had that situation that if I made it so that the SWR was higher on one line than the other, the signal seemed to improve vice versa, but that was a whole other ball game. Have you had enough punishment for this evening, Mr. Richard Pinedo?
Wow. Let me have a drop. My goodness, are we being formal? Yeah, I think I've had enough. Also, when you did intentionally unbalance your open wire line feeding your full wave loop 40 feet up in your backyard, what partially was happening there, Mel, is the unbalanced line was becoming a radiator, by definition. Only when it's balanced does it not radiate. So you've got a partially vertically polarized open wire line doing some of the radiating. You've got a horizontally polarized loop up in the air doing some of the radiating. And you can adjust how much of which when you adjust the degree of imbalance. Your further experiments with your loops in the shack, which are adaptable in polarization, where you can tilt and rotate more than one way until telling us now that the state of the ionosphere, accepting the fact that Faraday rotation is taking place, means that the polarization is nowhere near as simple as we thought. So that's part of what's going on. We amateurs have done very little recognition of what Faraday rotation is doing to us every hour of every day on the HF band when you're using the ionosphere. That ionosphere is a plasma, a radio signal propagating through a plasma that has a simultaneous magnetic field, that's what the Earth provides, will create Faraday rotation. And so that horizontal and vertical signal that you launch is going through the ionosphere with some number of rotations. And Faraday rotation decreases as you go up in frequency very rapidly, either square law or cube law, one over. Frequency ratio, I think it was square or cubed. And even the guys on 2 meters, 144 megacycles, for doing moonbound, see some huge differences from day to day on the Faraday rotation of the signal going straight through the ionosphere, straight up to the moon and straight back. Huge differences from day to day in Faraday rotation. And you're doing it at a grazing angle, at near 0 degree grazing angle into the ionosphere when you send that signal from New York to London, for instance. And you've got a lot more opportunity for a lot more mischief when it comes to Faraday rotation. You're at a lower frequency, you're doing it at a grazing angle, you're going through the ionosphere much longer distances, multiple times, because there's multiple bounces between here and Europe. And so rotation is something we've got. Rotation of polarization is something we keep forgetting. And boy, it's been biting us in the tail all these years. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, yeah, Roger. Oh, yeah, I speak to the same station. Boy, oh, boy. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, London. I'm talking about to Pennsylvania or to up to Massachusetts. And they come in. I go crazy because, you know, I always have to say, give me a long transmission so I can tune in with this thing. But first I got to figure out the angle, then I got to peak it, then I put it through the Q multiplier, then I adjust the amplifier in it, and you know, then finally, you know, after about a couple of minutes, I've got the station tuned in, of course. If I have a few stations I'm talking to, I make notes so I can go back and forth quickly of really which way I have the antenna and the angles and all that good stuff. The problem I had that time when I was doing the outside experiment with the loop, the full wavelength loop, is I had the feeder coming up and going over on an angle sort of to the other side of the loop. And that was the reason when I put it up. The reason for that, but that's ridiculous to go into. And when I was listening and talking to a couple of guys, one guy seemed to be, as they say, the maven on loops on 75 meters. He says, oh no, you've got to drop that open wire feeder right down and then into the shack. And Dick, I don't know why I went ahead and I went through a lot of trouble to do this. I got that feeder over on the other side, I recut it. Oh, God, don't know. Don't ask what I went through. And I dropped this feeder. Now it dropped from 45 feet down to about 10 feet above the ground. I don't want to get down with these open wire feeders right near the ground. And then I come back up into the shack, which is on the second floor. Now when I adjust the coupler for minimum SWR, they all say my signal is much better. If I throw it out either way, no good no more. It used to be the opposite, so. Something is making this feeder go straight up and down has changed the whole situation over, Dick, over.
Yep. I'm guessing you want the right ratio of horizontal polarization to vertical polarization, which is really launching some kind of a slant polarization, which with that state of the ionosphere that day gave them the best signal when it arrived in their backyard with their particular polarized antenna. We have been talking from time to time, we amateurs, about electronic steering of the beam. And we're talking about azimuth steering of the beam. Occasionally we talk about elevation steering of the beam. I'm solely concluding from what you've seen, Mel. Polarization theory is much more important, and we've been ignoring it. You can easily use a simplified antenna plotting program to plot your antenna pattern. You tell it what kind of an antenna, how many wavelengths above the ground, and it'll plot your antenna pattern of your antenna in the local vicinity. The program is not plotting what happens if the signal's been through the ionosphere. So we've been emphasizing electronic steering of azimuth. We've been ignoring electronic steering of polarization. We've got it backwards. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, no doubt. I can say there seems to be no end what you can experiment with. And I'm amazed after all the years. You know, you don't expect these things. I mean, this is coming, as they say, on the left field tonight. Again, I've only did a limited amount of transmitting with the indoor loop. The reason for that is, of course, you know, I kept the power low. I got an ideal condition just before we got this noise level going sky high during the summer months because, you know, there's constantly a thunderstorm somewhere out there in the United States, especially down south of the Florida area over there, the thunderstorm capital of the world. And so the noise level is pretty phenomenally high, and you wind up, you have to run usually in kilowatts just to make contact with your friends in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and Connecticut. So I'm not going to run a kilowatt into a loop sitting right next to me. I just don't feel like, you know, I don't know, not with a column, my Collins amplifier pouring into that loop. I mean, first of all, that thing most likely would fry the variable condenser right away. You're going to need a much heavier condenser there. I guess you'd have to hook something to a vacuum variable, so I just ruled that out. But, you know, again, to say that even that it would even be a competition that it, at any time it would be anywhere near as good as this outside, you know, it's almost, I could say when I did the experiment on AR-75, you know, you could well imagine the huh I was getting from people that you got a beam, you got a, what do you mean you're turning the antenna towards us on 75? What's going on here? You know, it sounds, I guess, if I heard it and didn't know much about it, Dick, I would say impossible.
Yeah, there is that one Japanese guy that's got this 180-foot-long boom Yagi, fully rotatable five-element Yagi on 80 meters. But he's known. And for such an antenna, a rotatable Yagi, rotatable, tunable antenna, on Dover Street in Brooklyn, in the Manhattan Beach area of Brooklyn, these guys you're talking to would say, no way in hell could that guy have done that without everybody knowing in New York City he did it. All 8 million people would know about it. Okay. I'm going to start saying 73s now. For those who've listened to all this jazz, this was TechNet number 1,143 of the series that began in 1982 in September. What was that now? Going on 25 years ago, if I got the numbers right. Yeah, this coming September it'll be 25 years of essentially continuous TechNet. Bunch of crazy people, labor of love. So, we'll be back next week. You guys try to go easy on Mel with all of those crazy emails you send him. Don't waste his time saying, I want to go to Brand A, Brand B, Brand C, who's the best transmitter? He doesn't answer those questions. Everybody's transmitter, properly used, can give you nearly full performance if you're using it right. As long as it's working, good working order. So, those are not the right fair questions. For people trying to understand how transmission lines work, how antennas work, how propagation works, and how to properly tune things and so on. If you're a tinkerer, go ahead and ask him his question. I think it's appropriate. But go easy with him on asking brand names, because I know what you guys are going through. When you first get into ham radio, you want a good transmitter, you want a good receiver, you want a good antenna, you want a good feed line. You start opening up the books and the catalogs, and there's 40 brands of each one to choose from. And you're darn afraid that if you lay down your valuable money, it's going to be the wrong one. It's hard to go wrong. And when in doubt, listen around and you'll eventually find out what people are using and become a copycat at first. Hey, so-and-so down the street is using brand A of coax and brand B of antenna and brand C of transmitter. I see the brand C transmitter being sold on eBay or on the flea market at a reasonable price. Not guaranteed to be in perfect working condition, but go ahead and buy it, and it's a reasonable price. With rare exception, if it's a known brand name, a guy like Andy, W-A-2-C-D-L, can make it work for you, among other people. So it's hard to get a bad one. Very few really bad ones are out there. And the few bad ones that are out there become pretty well known pretty fast. And my attitude when I buy a used piece of equipment, if it's got 90% of the electronics that I want inside that box,
repeater, timeout,
cancel. And even if it's been flown down the flight of stairs and the front panel is dented, I mean, the most valuable part of the transmitter might be the power transformer. The second most valuable part is the power output transistors. The third most valuable part maybe is the meter movement on the front panel. If it's got those things, it's got most of the value. The rest of it I can fix. Just a matter of attitude. But that's an opinion. Not everybody agrees with me. 73, you all? No? K2KUY, go right ahead.
Hey, very good. Yeah, I got a lot of questions like that. Is it worth fixing? What should I pay for it? You know, which one should I buy, and everything like that. It could be background of everything from their financial statements, and on and on and on. What antenna, and who make, and why, and where, and when. I got 83 of them this past week, and out of them, I'm sorry. Again, we can't comment much on, you know, prices, things, and quality of a product, one product over another. So, you want to just send me emails about questions just like we just had about antennas, you know, and grounds and radios and things like that, verticals and horizontal and speed lines. I'm more than glad to, you know, whatever I can answer quickly, I'll answer if I think it's interesting and it needs more detailed answering. I'm sure more people are interested up here on the TechNet. Of course, I'll bring it up here on the TechNet. But anything to do with the financial, your financial statements and everything like that, you know, I just can't sit down and read all these. Some of them are awful long. So anyhow, thank you for all those. Do send me emails, the ones I can answer. And we'll look forward to doing it again next week. 73, have a great week. This is K2KTY.